I can't hear you.
I have a copy of the demonstrative I'm going to use.
If you'll give it to the bailiff, he can distribute it.
Mr. Sebastian is not a sexually violent predator, nor can he be one based upon the evidence that the state presented at trial or the criteria that they now argue applies to civil commitments. Civil commitment involves a finding of two facts by the jury, one, that he has a mental abnormality as defined by law, and two, that he has risk as defined by law caused by that mental abnormality. The state's brief argues it made a submissible case and the evidence was sufficient to meet the statutory definition of mental abnormality. But that definition is not constitutional, and we know that because the United States Supreme Court and this court has told us so. The state relies on evidence that it was able to prove Mr. Sebastian was a menace to the health and safety of others. But it does not claim its evidence was sufficient to find that he had serious difficulty controlling his behavior. But SVP statutes are only constitutional and their subsequent commitments so long as serious difficulty controlling behavior is required and proven. It's constitutionally required to distinguish someone from the typical, albeit dangerous, criminal recidivist. And the evidence at this trial, even if the state were to argue the correct elements, didn't prove Mr. Sebastian has a mental abnormality because it cannot show he had serious difficulty controlling his behavior. The state offered one diagnosis as the basis of mental abnormality, and that was pedophilia. At trial, Dr. Kircher testified serious difficulty controlling behavior means a disorder, in this case pedophilia, is running someone's life and he is controlled by it. And she testified she had no idea if Mr. Sebastian was or ever had been run by pedophilia or that he was controlled by it, and she testified she had no opinion at the time of trial. Therefore, the state is left with the testimony of Dr. Witcher. Dr. Witcher testified that there is a spectrum of behavioral control. And during her testimony, she and I created a demonstrative that's in the record as Exhibit AA. Dr. Witcher said there is a difference in some behavioral control problem and serious difficulty controlling behavior. She testified that on the far end of the spectrum would be total loss of control, and on the opposite would be no problem with behavioral control. She was asked where serious difficulty controlling behavior fell on the spectrum, and she indicated here, the top portion near total discontrol or total loss of control. She also unequivocally testified that pedophilia caused some difficulty, which was denominated here on the demonstrative during her testimony. There is no way pedophilia causing some difficulty could ever fall within the range she indicated would be serious difficulty controlling behavior, and where the behavioral control problem had to fall in order for the state to make a submissible case and produce sufficient evidence to obtain his commitment.
If I understand, you're saying using the term pedophilia is not sufficient because that covers a wide range from some difficulty to serious difficulty or no control. You're not saying pedophilia is only some.
I'm not saying pedophilia is only some in every situation, but the uncontested testimony from Dr. Witcher was, in this particular case, for Mr. Sebastian, it was her opinion pedophilia caused some. And because we are talking about Mr. Sebastian and not every person who could ever have the diagnosis or ever be subjected to civil commitment, it matters what his behavioral control was.
And did she testify he was more likely than not to offend?
She ultimately gave that conclusion, yes.
And so why doesn't that move it past the sum to more likely than not?
Because her conclusion had to be supported by the record. And based on testimony that pedophilia only caused some difficulty controlling behavior, it wouldn't support her own conclusion.
But she looked at a lot of the records and his testing of him and so forth. She didn't base it on a label. She based it on all her examination and said he was more likely than not. You may be right, but why wasn't that a fact question?
So there are two different issues. More likely than not has to do with the risk prong, and serious difficulty controlling behavior is part of the four components of mental abnormality. And to get to more likely than not, you first have to establish and prove there is a mental abnormality.
So you're saying he had no mental abnormality?
Correct.
And that a diagnosis of pedophilia is not itself sufficient to constitute a mental abnormality?
Correct. As our statute has defined mental abnormality, and as this court has interpreted that definition, a mental abnormality is a congenital or acquired condition that predisposes someone to commit sexually violent offenses in such a degree that they have serious difficulty controlling their behavior. All of those components or elements are part of mental abnormality, and there must be evidence on each one of those components to satisfy the mental abnormality prong. Only then, when we are convinced there is evidence of a mental abnormality, do we look at risk. So those are two different issues.
Thank you.
The state also failed to make a submissible case on the risk issue, which is, did pedophilia, as the mental abnormality, cause Mr. Sebastian to be more likely than not to commit future predatory acts of sexual violence based on the binding definition of predatory in Section 632.480.03. At trial, the jury was admonished that Dr. Kircher had no opinion as to the purpose of Sebastian's conduct, because she had given deposition testimony that she didn't know the purpose of his behavior, and that wasn't something she could ever know. So again, the state's only evidence as to this element would be testimony from Dr. Witcher. Dr. Witcher was asked on direct about Mr. Sebastian's underlying sexually violent offense and was asked, in your opinion, was that act done for the primary purpose of victimization? Over Mr. Sebastian's objection, she testified he went in to commit a sexual act in order to assist his own sexual gratification. And it was against an 11-year-old child. That is what I can say. She agreed there was a sexual purpose involved. She also agreed that the definition of predatory in the statute requires the purpose is for victimization. And again, she was asked by the state's attorney, do you see that in Mr. Sebastian's offending history? And her answer, not consciously, no. So I believe that he did not go in saying, I'm going to do this in order to hurt someone. I do not believe that was the drive of his behavior. The drive of his behavior, Dr. Witcher would testify, again, was sexual in nature for sexual gratification. But the act defines predatory as an act done for the primary purpose of victimization. Dr. Witcher and the state are relying on something she said on cross, trying to fix her answer, where she testified, it doesn't have to necessarily be a conscious decision to go out and victimize someone. The victimization happens secondary. Dr. Witcher testified she knows of lots of sex offenders who do go out purposefully to victimize. She said that someone who had committed a sex offense, specifically doing it with the intent to hurt someone, would be the example of acting for the primary purpose of victimization. But that is not how she believed the evidence appeared in this case, and not how she characterized Mr. Sebastian's conduct.
So your argument is a primary purpose to victimize must be a conscious, intentional purpose,
yes,
and it
ma'am.
Cannot be what is subconsciously driving the person.
Yes, ma'am.
And where do you get that in the statute?
The statute doesn't give that definition. That would
right.
be my interpretation based on the plain language that is there. If the intent must be to victimize someone, that means the intent must be to do what it is to victimize, that is to hurt someone. And if your intent is for any other purpose, it would not be victimization. I understand that when a sex offense occurs, there is a victim when it is a contact offense. But if the legislature merely meant that someone has created a victim, they would not have included predatory in the criteria that must be proven, and they would not have defined predatory in the manner which they chose to do that.
But why does it matter if it's conscious or unconscious?
Well, I think that's what distinguishes someone from a typical sexual offender who is best dealt with in the criminal system.
But does the statute think that? Why under the statute does it have to be conscious or consciously as opposed to unconsciously?
Because it speaks directly to the individual's intent when they are going out to do something. I can't intend to do something if I'm not consciously acting or consciously seeking out that purpose. If it's an ancillary or a consequence of my conduct that was intended to accomplish something else, it very likely, and I would agree, that it does create a harmful effect for someone else. But that's not the intent in acting. And that wouldn't be the primary purpose of someone's actions.
So if you're self-deluding, then you can't be convicted, you can't be found to be an SVP under the statute.
Under the language as the statute is written, I think that could be the case.
Okay, thank you.
And the state's attorney in closing argument also acknowledged that Mr. Sebastian's primary purpose was not victimization. The state's closing argument discussed Mr. Sebastian's offenses, and he said when he did them, that was for sexual gratification, and that's the primary purpose. And it created victims. But the statute doesn't define predatory as the primary purpose for sexual gratification and you commit victims. It defines it as the primary purpose of victimizing someone, not as a secondary consequence. The only reasonable inference that could be drawn from this evidence is that, yes, Mr. Sebastian committed a sexually violent offense act, and that his primary purpose was to gratify his personal sexual desire, and it was for personal fulfillment. Where the testimony was, he never intended to hurt someone, and he never went out going, I'm going to do this to hurt someone, he could not be predatory based upon the evidence that the state elected to present to the jury.
Is there anything to the adage that you intend the natural and probable consequences of your acts? Does that fit in here at all?
I don't think that's part of the statutory definition.
Well, but that's a part of thousands of cases.
I suppose the court could choose to interpret the statute that way. Why it matters what your intent is committing an act, is why these laws have been deemed constitutional, because they're distinguishing someone who is so mentally ill that they are subjected to civil commitment from someone who is a criminal offender who will continue to recidivate. Those men are dangerous, and we have laws that are in place to deal with them. And as Hendricks tells us in Crane, they're better dealt with by the criminal justice system. The difference in perhaps a criminal offender who recidivates with a sex offense and someone who is truly a sexually violent predator is someone who goes out and commits the sex offense deliberately, willfully, and intentionally to harm someone else. Not that it's a secondary consequence of their actions.
Thank you.
You're welcome. If there are any further questions, I'm happy to answer those, or I will give the floor to my opposing
Thank
counsel.
You.
May it please the court.
Certainly.
Constitutional challenges to SVP laws are currently subjected to different standards of review depending on whether those challenges are brought in state court or in federal court. Accordingly, the state is asking this court revisit its previous rulings that SVP laws are subject to strict scrutiny and that it follow the lead of the federal courts in adopting rational basis standard of review.
You cite the Eighth Circuit's recent decision.
Right.
How about the other federal courts?
I have not found any federal appellate court that has applied strict scrutiny to these particular cases.
I believe the rational basis, do they say what they're applying, or do they just not say?
I believe that the Ninth Circuit has done that, and perhaps the Fourth as well. I was able to find very few federal appellate cases that explicitly address that particular subject. But certainly what the Eighth Circuit has done is consistent with what the United States Supreme Court has suggested in its cases. The Supreme Court, of course, for strict scrutiny review to apply, there has to be a state action that infringes upon a fundamental liberty interest. And while there certainly is a liberty interest in freedom from undue restraint, the question is, does that rise to the level of a fundamental right that thus triggers strict scrutiny review?
Opposing counsel does cite parts of Supreme Court cases that call it a fundamental right. They don't explicitly address what level of scrutiny is being applied, but at various times they have said it's part of the fundamental liberty right.
In certain contexts, that's true, but certainly in the context of involuntary commitments, even those not involving SVPs, rational basis has been the standard. For instance, Jones and Jackson are a couple of cases from the U.S. Supreme Court that in the context of involuntary commitment found that those commitment laws must bear some rational relation to the purpose for which the person was committed. Of course, that's language from rational basis review. And the Supreme Court in Hendricks, I think, signaled that we're not dealing with a fundamental right here, even though it did not explicitly discuss strict versus rational basis, because it borrowed language from the Glucksberg case, which defined a fundamental right as those deeply rooted in the nation's history, and this is the language in particular, implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. Now, in looking at SVP cases, particularly the Kansas statute, the court in Hendricks said that SVP laws are not contrary to our understanding of ordered liberty. And I think that suggests very clearly that the Supreme Court is finding that these laws do not implicate a fundamental right that triggers strict scrutiny review. That's certainly the way the Eighth Circuit interpreted that in the Piper case and came to the decision that it came to. And I note also that Schaefer case, Van Orden versus Schaefer case, that the appellant has relied on heavily in many of her constitutional claims, specifically rejected an argument that it should use strict scrutiny review and instead used rational basis review.
Which arguments that are being made are affected by which level of scrutiny we apply? Do we need to resolve this issue?
Right. Well, while we don't concede that the outcome ultimately would be any different, there are several points where the defendant has argued that the statute does not survive strict scrutiny review, and those specifically are points 6, 7, 9, 10, and 11 in her brief. And I think it's also important to reach this issue because, of course, there are several of these cases pending in the courts of appeals, some of them raising these same constitutional issues. I know I have a couple myself in the Western District. And, of course, because the Court of Appeals is constitutionally bound to follow this court's latest controlling authority, that in this case would be the Norton and Burnett opinions, which have adopted strict scrutiny review. So it would be helpful to those courts to get some clarification on the appropriate standard of review and also to bring some consistency to these cases in terms of looking at them under the federal constitution so that litigants in state courts aren't having to deal with a different standard than litigants that bring their claims in the federal courts, which is currently the case here. So we would ask the court to do that, and if there are more specific questions, I think we've outlined in the brief why we think the underpinnings of Norton perhaps aren't correct, because it relied on a series of U.S. Supreme Court cases, didn't appear to rely on any separate provision of the Missouri Constitution, and of course, traditionally, the Missouri Constitution's equal protection and due process provisions have been interpreted as being coextensive with the federal provisions in that constitution and not as providing any greater or different degree of protection. I guess the one case I would point out that was cited in Norton was the Foucher case, which is the only one that seemed to use a heightened standard of review, although it was a little unclear as to whether it didn't strictly adopt the strict scrutiny language, so it's not entirely clear what portion that opinion the standard was. That portion of the opinion was a plurality decision, by the way. But it involved a very unique situation where a defendant had been acquitted on an NGRI basis, but the state wanted to continue to hold him in custody even though he no longer suffered from a mental illness, wanted to hold him solely on the basis of future dangerousness without having to prove it by clear and convincing evidence. That differs greatly from the SVP statute here because there has to be that finding of a mental abnormality. And both the mental abnormality and the future dangerousness have to be proven by clear and convincing evidence. So we're talking about a statute in Fauci that did not provide the level of protection that the SVP statute provides. So while perhaps strict scrutiny in that kind of a situation maybe would be appropriate, it doesn't mandate a finding of strict scrutiny in the context of the SVP case. And
why don't you determine what kind of scrutiny you have to apply by looking at the interest involved, and a liberty interest in many contexts is given strict scrutiny. Why does the level of scrutiny you give a liberty interest change depending upon the context?
Well, because the liberty interest has never been an absolute one. For instance, in the context
of... Of course, it's not absolute, but it's subject to strict scrutiny,
right. Saying,
versus heightened or...
Well, and what the... I believe it was the Eighth Circuit that discussed this, is that traditionally these involuntary civil commitments are something that's a well-accepted and long-standing practice. So it's not something that is contrary to our traditional understanding of what is and what is not an acceptable infringement on liberty. And in the SVP case, you're looking at an even more limited subset of that. People that not just are mentally ill, but that are potentially dangerous. And the societal interest in that case in protecting the public from those people outweighs the liberty interest that the person might otherwise have if they did not share those characteristics.
Go ahead. Can you address the primary purpose and the primary intent argument made by opposing counsel about whether you have to have a purpose to injure the victim? I'm switching topics on you there because I don't
sure.
want to take all your time.
If I'm understanding, is that the predatory nature of the uh-huh. Well, you know, the statute sets forth certain things the state has to prove, but I think, as was noted, it doesn't go ahead and define necessarily what those are. We leave it to the medical experts to fill in the gaps in terms of what constitutes a mental abnormality, whether or not that mental abnormality causes someone serious behavior in controlling difficulty in controlling their behavior, and the predatory purpose. In this case, the experts gave their definition of what a predatory purpose is. Jury's free to believe or disbelieve that, but as a medical, it becomes a question of fact for the jury to decide whether or not the behaviors of this specific person in this specific instance were done with the primary intent. And there's nothing about the definition that Dr. Witcher in particular used that is clearly contrary to the language of the statute. It simply does not... that use of the word predatory does not give any particular guidance or say it has to be this or that. These are ultimately medical questions that are dealt with by trained and licensed psychologists for them to answer and to provide a basis for the jury to either find or not find that the person meets the statutory definition. And then I would also emphasize that the experts for the state were very clear in their testimony that in reaching their opinions to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty, that they were relying on the statutory standards. They were not out making up their own, that they applied the information that they were able to gather and their diagnosis to the language of the statute and found that to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty, that the appellant in this case met those standards for being declared an SVP under what the statute requires. Basically, this argument and every sufficiency argument that's being raised here is asking this court to second guess the information and the opinions of the experts and to reweigh the evidence to substitute its own credibility determinations for those of the jury.
Does the statute address what your primary purpose has to be to be an SVP?
Yeah, without trying to get the exact wording off the top of my head.
Opposing counsel said it has to be the primary purpose. I'm trying to get your response to her argument where she said the statute said the primary purpose has to be to injure the victim, and simply the primary purpose being sexual gratification is insufficient.
It's a dangerous... I know the statute talks in terms of future dangerousness of committing predatory acts. I don't... Off the top of my head, I'm not sure I've seen a primary purpose language in the statute. If I'm incorrect, I apologize, but the exact language of the statute isn't coming to me. But I think what the experts were addressing was that predatory acts and what meets that definition of that. As I understand the argument, it's going to whether the evidence was sufficient to show what's a predatory act, which is not something I think that, to my recollection, is not specifically defined in the statute.
Thank you.
Could you address the argument the sufficiency of the evidence to prove a serious difficulty in controlling behavior rather than some difficulty or some lesser amount?
Certainly. And now let's go to page 16 in my brief where I summarize Dr. Witcher's testimony. She said that his pedophilia rose to the level of a mental abnormality because it predisposed him to commit sexually violent offenses to a degree that caused him serious difficulty in controlling his behavior. She reached that conclusion based on all the factors at hand, her quote, including the fact that the appellant had reoffended after being involved in juvenile sex offenses and going through juvenile sex offender treatment. And she also found that he had a pattern of behavior that had been present throughout his life, including behavior that he engaged in after undergoing sex offender treatment. That evidence is sufficient for the jury to make a finding that the defendant in this case had serious difficulty controlling his behavior. And of course, the evidence and inferences are looked at in the light most favorable to the verdict, and anything that contrary to that is disregarded. The experts in this case relied on information that's reasonably relied on by experts in their field. They reached their conclusions to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty. The courts held before that's what it takes to make a sufficient case, and any criticisms of those opinions and the manner in which they were reached go to the weight of the evidence, not its sufficiency. And that's at base what all these sufficiency arguments are going to is trying to reweigh the evidence, trying to disregard the doctor's own expertise and submit some different standard than what they use to reach their opinions. The testimony created fact questions for the jury. It was able to assess the evidence, the credibility of the witness, determine which opinions it believed and which it did not. The jury performed that function, and the jury's verdict is supported by sufficient evidence.
What's the current status of the federal litigation?
The Eighth Circuit opinion, to my knowledge, a motion for a rehearing by the court en banc has been filed. I'm not aware of whether that's been ruled on or not. I tried to access PACER and didn't have the right password.
That's a case based out of Minnesota, isn't it?
That's the Minnesota case. The Missouri case, I believe, is still pending in terms of the remedy portion of it. And even if the remedy portion has been decided in some manner, that case is, of course, still subject to appellate review by the Eighth Circuit as an initial matter. So we don't really know where that case is going to go. And, of course, that's, again, a trial court order dealing with a very specific subset of plaintiffs and very specific issues regarding whether the release procedures are being applied constitutionally to them. We're dealing here with an appeal from an initial order of commitment where we're a long way from the point where this appellant would even be eligible potentially for release. So that's one more reason that case really has no controlling effect on what is done here. Unless there are any other questions, we'd ask that the judgment of the probate court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Where an expert's ultimate opinion is not supported by competent evidence in the record, it does not support a reasonable inference as to an ultimate issue, and it is insufficient to create a submissible case. That is the issue that we have here. It's not attack on the expert's foundation and therefore admissibility. It wasn't an attack on their facts and data that they relied upon, but the probative value of their ultimate opinions in deciding the ultimate issues by the jury. The state's attorney said that the experts gave their definition of predatory, and that's problematic in this case because the legislature gave its definition of predatory too. And where the legislature defines a term, we are to use that definition, not one concocted by an expert. Predatory, yes, sir.
Were you getting to say the statutory definition of predatory?
I am.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Predatory is defined in 632.480 subsection 3. And it is defined as acts directed at individuals, including family members, for the primary purpose of victimization. We do not have to guess what the definition is or rely on a definition of the experts. Predatory is not a medical or psychological term.
And what's the definition of victimization? Is that in the statute?
Victimization is not in the statute. Based upon the testimony of the experts in this case, victimization would be intending to harm someone.
And where, as opposed to, I mean, conscious intent has to be to harm them, or to, you're relying on the experts there as opposed to the statute?
Yes, as opposed to the statute as to what victimization means, because that is not defined by the statute. Predatory is not a psychological or medical term. It is purely legal, and Dr. Witcher needs to be held accountable to the statutory standard just like anyone else.
So where do you get, are we compelled to apply the definition of victimization that the experts did?
I don't think so. I think when the term is, since it is undefined, we can use the common and ordinary meaning of that. My understanding of victimization, if someone were to say that to me, it would be purposefully hurting someone, creating a victim, and that being my intent.
Could it be submitting them to sexual acts that they don't have the ability to consent to?
That certainly could be an example of victimization, yes. And our statute requires that the primary purpose be to victimize. And under how this has played out, I believe in our prior cases before this court and the Court of Appeals, that it's deliberately to hurt someone, not just to commit a sex offense. If that were the case, this wouldn't distinguish someone from the ordinary but typical recidivist. And we would just be using a civil measure as a criminal sentence or an extension of that instead of fulfilling a civil or remedial purpose through the SVP Act. I do think strict scrutiny is the appropriate standard to apply. This court should continue doing that. The state relies heavily on the dissenting opinion by Justice Thomas in Fucha, who himself acknowledges that the majority in that case applied heightened due process scrutiny. Both the Minnesota SVP case and the federal Missouri case cited Jackson versus Indiana. And in that case, there was no basis whatsoever for the government's discriminatory conduct. And the sentence from the court that has been misconstrued is, at the very least, due process requires at least a rational basis. And of course, the court wasn't obligated to analyze the facts under a higher strict scrutiny standard because it couldn't meet the lowest bottom level of scrutiny that we apply. There is no reason for us to change course in this case. In all of the government's conduct in an SVP action, from initial civil commitment through the very end of release, is subject to strict scrutiny. And it does matter that release is unconstitutional, because where it's unconstitutional and punitive punishment, as we know from the Eastern District of Missouri, that means the front-end processes and procedures have to protect someone from an erroneous commitment that we know they will never get out of. And that's the case here with Mr. Sebastian. He had turned 18 when he put his hand on the stomach of a little girl, and it was wrong and it was a crime. But he served his time, and he's not a sexually violent predator.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.